Hi folks, Barry here, popping into your ears before you listen to this week's episode of Worstwood Forward with our guest, stand-up comedian Andrea Hubert, talking about the world's worst pain. For the squeamish among you, there's all sorts to enjoy. There's insects, there's tonsillitis, there's descriptions of jellyfish stings, there's all sorts. So if you're listening to this on your Monday commute to work, I really hope it's a lovely start to your day. Just to say that recording this was a bit tricky. Andrea's internet connection was playing up when we were doing it, so we had a bit of a delay at some points and dropouts completely at others. Hopefully, the edit that I have scrambled together isn't too bad and you still enjoy as much as you would normally do. Thank you as ever to our lovely Patreon donors for keeping the show on the road. Thanks to Janine, who got in touch to wish me a happy recovery from my COVID, which is very nice. And to all of those on Patreon who help support the show monetarily. If you think you would like to join that merry band, visit patreon.com/worstwoodforward. Chuck us a few quid monthly, or a lump sum for the whole year, and help pay Ben and I's wages, help support extra bonus episodes and other endeavours, live shows that we hope we might get to do over the course of the year. And you can get extra bonus content on there. You get the chance to request a specific topic for the show and even appear as a judge on the show. So head on over to Patreon if you want to help us out in that way. Or, as a couple of people have been doing in the last week or two, write a lovely review for us on iTunes. We haven't asked for that for a while, but it very much helps keep us buoyant in the charts in wherever around the world you are listening to us. Finally, thanks as ever to the lovely people that we have on our Discord channel and on our Twitter and everywhere else. It's always really heartening for Ben and I to hear from you, whether it's sharing a story you think we'll enjoy, or watching you debate whatever we've been talking about on the show this week, or, as is often the case for some of you, correcting Ben on his rather lax knowledge of his Jewish heritage. Whatever it is, we love hearing from you, so keep it up on @worstfoot, or drop us an email, worstwoodforwardpodcast@gmail.com. That'll do. It's late. I've got two shows at my job tomorrow, and you've got a podcast to listen to. Hello and welcome to Worstwood Forward, the podcast that celebrates the best of the worst. I'm Barry McStay, and each week I, my co-host and our guest, propose our candidates for the title of the world's worst something. The poet Khalil Gibran wrote the following in their poem On Pain. Your pain is the breaking of the shell that encloses your understanding. Even as the stone of the fruit must break, that its heart may stand in the sun, so must you know pain. And could you keep your heart in wonder at the daily miracles of your life, your pain would not seem less wondrous than your joy. And you would accept the seasons of your heart, even as you have always accepted the seasons that pass over your fields. And you would watch with serenity through the winters of your grief. Which is a lot to process in the moments after you step on an upturned plug. So I'll just settle for a loud, anguished cry of FUCK instead. Thanks. And with me is the pain in my neck, the ache in my heart, and the unsettling rumble in my bowels. It's Ben Vandeveld.
Hello, I'm feeling particularly spiky and abrasive after that introduction. Listen, I am not just any little brother. I'm a little brother 13 years the junior of his big brother, which means that I am well honed and trained at being the biggest pain I can possibly be.
Was that your role in the dynamic between you and your older brother?
Oh, absolutely, mate. That's what was on the business card I used to hand out at primary school.
A sidebar, by the way, I've always thought the name analgesia was a really nice name for a child.
Something that is analgesic and anigelsic.
Anigelsic was a Swedish footballer in the 80s, I think.
Yes.
And neuralgia, that's another good pain name.
I do like neuralgia as a good pain name. I think I'm going to have to stop saying it. I think that anigelsia wasn't a footballer. I think if it makes you feel better, then it was definitely a trainer who came in with the magic sponge. Anyway, what's your pain threshold like?
I don't know. I think it's quite good, apart from when I'm taking things out of the oven. Because I've got quite, like, relatively hairy backs of my hands. So as soon as I reach it, like, even, like, you know, not actually trying to take something out without oven gloves, but you're opening the oven door and just sort of having a look. If my hand is anywhere near it, immediate, like, no-no. So anytime I'm watching, you know, Gordon Ramsay or one of the TV chefs and they're handling things that must be flaming hot with their asbestos limbs, it seems like magic to me.
Yeah, oh, that no, that's different, though, if you are a professional chef. Like, my father-in-law runs an Italian cafe, and his hands and forearms are horrific. They... Like, honestly, his forearms look like no man's land in the Somme. There is no way he has any feeling left in them. So don't judge yourself by that very high standard.
That's true. I've got the hands of someone who types for a living.
There you go.
What about you? Are you relatively pain immune?
No, I'm quite pathetic. Well, it's weird.
End of podcast. cue the theme music.
If I know the pain is coming, I've learnt various techniques to deal with it. But actually, I'll tell you how good I am at dealing with pain. As listeners of the show might know, this time last year, I had a abscess on a dead tooth, which is absolutely the worst pain I've ever experienced in my life. And one of my wife's friends said, oh, I had that too. It was worse than childbirth. And I managed to, whilst having this abscess on my tooth, function as a reasonably effective parent. And so I am absolutely, ironically, dining out on the dead tooth. As going, this guy got a pretty high pain threshold because he can experience childbirth in his mouth and get on with...
Get like on with China in your hand, childbirth in your mouth.
Yeah, exactly. It's time to introduce this week's guest. She is a stand-up comedian and writer who has been garlanded with the BAFTA Norcliffe Award, one of the most respected and sought-after new writing awards in the industry. She's had a variety of excellent and dark sitcoms in development. In fact, darkness is one of the words that often orbits her comedy. If I were a lazy person, then I would introduce her as deliciously dark. But the thing is, her comedy is deliciously dark in the way that eating some charred venison that suddenly bursts to life in your belly and gallops out of your gullet, firing juniper berries at your head, is. What I'm saying is, well, she's weird, nice. And she's dark, and I like her a lot.
Thanks, Ben. That was so nice. That was so sweet.
I was really trying to work out what a good way to introduce you was without going, she's dead funny, she does really dark stuff, and I'm a big fan of her work. And instead of just saying that directly, I went off on one.
I mean, I don't even understand this darkness. I'm literally on stage talking about my mother.
Shining a light where it deserves to be shone.
I know, I'm just talking about the day of her death mostly at the moment. she has not died. just planning ahead. But I see what you mean. I get it now.
I mean, God, we've known each other for well over a decade, Andrea, and you're one of the comics who I love watching most, A, because you're dead funny, but B, to see what sort of noises you're going to make the audience make beyond laughter.
Sometimes not beyond laughter, sometimes it's only noises, and that's more upsetting than cool in a lot of ways. But but thank you. I feel very loved and appreciated.
We should stop being sincere. It suits neither of us.
I don't like it.
Do you have a high pain threshold?
I have a high tolerance for pain through pure laziness and refusal to get up and go to the doctor. So I will live with something painful for a really long time rather than deal with it. I don't like that kind of thing. I don't like going to the doctor. I don't like having to listen to the doctor. I don't like somebody telling me things, and I just get really annoyed. So yes, I can live with pain for a really long time. I wouldn't say any of that is healthy. I would say all of that is weird. In terms of could I take a punch? No, definitely not. Like,
if you did, you'd refuse treatment. That's the key.
Yeah, I just wouldn't get it for ages. I'd be like, why does my nose hurt? So annoying. Why do I feel
The last couple of years with all of the medical experts on TV telling people what to do must have been a nightmare for you.
No, I mean, don't get me wrong. I'm not. I'm like fully on board with them telling me what I think what I mean is it's like what they tell me often involves me having to do more than just go to the doctor. So like right now I'm in the middle of a whole thing and I won't get into it because it's absolutely disgusting. But suffice it to say that the reason none of the stuff is working is because I haven't actually been doing it. And so there's no way the pain will end until I take the instructions of the doctor that I paid to see, you know? So here, yeah. Here we are. Am I in pain? Yes. Emotionally or physically? It's obviously both. So yeah, can I take it? You bet I can.
Well, that is, I don't know if it's a very British thing or a very human thing, but I remember slightly injuring my back and being given a series of simple exercises that would take up barely 5 minutes of my time in order to help me recuperate. Did I do those exercises? Did I fuck? But it feels like a lot of British/human people will take that to the nth degree where they're like, well, you know, I'm pretty certain it's a tumour, but God, it's going to take hours on the operating table to get it out. So
you've just described my, you know, health plan and pension. Like, just exactly.
I was imagining the Grim Reaper showing up at your front door and you ignoring his consistent ringing of the doorbell.
Yeah, like, I cannot get up right now. I'm really busy.
Yeah. So hang on. Andrea's approach to the Grim Reaper will be the same as most people's approach to Jehovah's Witnesses.
That is exactly what I'm saying.
Well, I'll just scream I'm a Jew in his face until he leaves me alone. You know we die, right?
To be honest, if the Grim Reaper called at my door as a little Jewish man, I'd be like, hey, at least the hood's black rather than white.
Oh, yes. I mean, yeah, that's... I never even thought of that. I just can't quite get to the door.
But on the flip side, I guess, if he did come in and start hacking at you, it would probably look like the Black Knight in Monty Python. He's just lopping limbs off you, Andrea, and you're going, just but a scratch. And carrying on as per normal.
You know what? I wouldn't be a martyr about it. I'd just be like, get the tumour while you're there. But
Well, no, I imagine that the Reaper would lose all confidence and be like, oh, bollocks to it. I'll just take the tumour and you can stay put.
But yeah, you mean like those teenage girls who drive priests to like leave the priesthoods with their terrible confessions? I would like to do that. Yeah, I think I'm past that stage now, but I could certainly catch up as an old lady. I love it. I mean, is this what the podcast is about? Just planning my death? Because I love that, by the way.
Yeah, surprise.
I actually really like that because I'd like, here's what I'd ask them. I'd be like, all right, let's describe the funeral. We'll do guest list and then we'll do revenge speeches. Do you know what I mean? Like, if you have. Like, who do you want to give a piece of your mind to? There has to be someone. No one gets to the end of their life with having said everything they've got to say. So, yeah.
It's your and furthermore from beyond the grave.
Yeah.
I'm going to co-opt a very old John Oliver joke and say it should be called a fuck eulogy.
Yeah, very good. Yeah.
Yeah.
Very good.
Now, we have discovered that you are excellent at comedy, good at lazily ignoring your pain, and a wonder at planning yours and other people's funerals. But what are you worst at, Andrea?
It was so many things that I had to write a list. Like, I'm very good at, like, maybe no things, but maybe half a thing, and really, really bad at loads of stuff. It was a really depressing sort of hour for me where I just thought about all the things I was bad at and how I'd never get good at them ever in my life and what was really ruminating.
You're welcome.
And I finally worked out the thing that I wish I could do that I cannot do, that I'm incredibly bad at, is like, I can't really, and you're going to laugh at this, Ben, because you know me and you'll think that's not true. I can't really stand up for myself in really tiny situations. So like, for example, a small child kicking the back of my seat and its mother not stopping it, I find that almost impossible to navigate. And like, I've seen other people do it nicely, but whenever, if I try and go in, I go in way too hard, like way too hard. And if I, and I'm also scared to do it. I can't, I've teenage children kicking the back of my chair. Like I wouldn't even bother. I would look for any other seat. I'm a 6'1" woman. I should not be running away from teenagers, but there's something in me that can, because I don't know what I think is going to happen. If I turn around and say, sorry, could you stop kicking my chair? Like, do I immediately think I'll get stabbed by a teen? No, probably not. So why am I so scared? Do I think they're going to start mocking the way I speak? Yes, I do. And I don't enjoy that. I don't know why.
Is it mainly children, this, or is it adults as well?
No, it's not only children. It's anyone who's doing something that I think is socially unacceptable. And I know people who just be like, could you not do that? Could you please not play your music so loudly? You're scaring that woman, or you're doing this, or can you not? And a lot of times those people will just be like, oh, sorry. But yeah. I, in my head, everyone who's doing a transgression in my mind is also a violent criminal who is going to. I'm just bad at getting what I want, guys. I think that's where we're at with it.
What level of like social transgression is are you immediately thinking mass murderer? Because like
it's a very low level of transgression.
They're already irredeemable in your eyes.
Yeah, as we're saying it out loud, I'm wondering if that's where I'm going wrong in certain areas. But again, that's not really this kind of podcast.
Yeah. we are going to talk about the world's worst pain. And Ben, you're going to lead us off and we'll see where exactly the ache is emanating from with you. Let's go.
There's only one place to start with this topic, and it is the Schmidt-Sting pain index. When I went to the Natural History Museum a few years ago, there was an exhibition based around the work by Justin O. Schmidt, a entomologist from Arizona. He claims to have been stung by the majority of stinging insects. He has been stung over 80 times, and he has created, in his words, a tasting menu for stings. He has also been referred to as the pain sommelier. Obviously, that'll be very confusing for French people who are like, a bread sommelier, I can roll with that. But, I'll take it. I'll happily take it.
Listen, I'm going to do it now. I was going to do it during my bit, but I also Googled the world's worst pan, the French for bread, in my research. And let me tell you guys, there is a whole ding-dong in France between what they call the pan au chocolat.
While we're here, pan au chocolat is almost always hugely disappointing because there is far too much pan, which isn't actually pan, and then too little threaded turds of poo through the middle of chocolate through the middle of it.
Like, where are you getting your pan au chocolat? That doesn't sound right at all, Ben.
Yeah.
Dear God, man, go to a nice cafe.
Yeah, I'm guessing that Crazy Pierre's coprolite patisserie is not the place to go.
Well, there was a thing called the chocolatine, which was created by an Austrian baker called August Zang. He opened a boulangerie in Paris in the 1830s. He sold Viennese croissants with chocolate, which he called them chocolade and croissants, or chocolatines, as they'd say in French. And they were sort of contrasted with the traditional chocolate and bread sandwich a lot of French school children had been eating for generations, which the French called the pain au chocolat. But to the mind of the consumer, by the sort of over the course of the 19th century, they kind of became the same thing. And most of France called the pastry a pain au chocolat as well. But in Gascony, in the southwest, it has always been called a chocolatine. And there was a local word, a chicolatina, which was sort of in a local dialect. So they think they sort of hung on to that because it was already an existing local word. And it is still to this day, in 2018, 10 parliamentary deputies from the southwest tabled a motion in Parliament demanding that the term chocolatine be given the same status as pain au chocolat. This is not just a chocolatine amendment, said Aurélien Pradier, a young deputy from Lot. It is an amendment that aims to protect popular expressions that give value to culinary expertise. It's essentially, and they said, they wanted to defeat the pain au chocolat snobbery of our Parisian colonies.
This is the most French thing I've ever heard in my life.
Do you want to know the result of the vote?
Go on.
The amendment was voted down. Pain au chocolat remains the official term in France. We know the French Academy obviously is very, very much the arbiter of how things should be named in France. And however, I mean, they call them chocolat, croissant au chocolat in Alsace, petit pain au chocolat in Hauts-de-France, couque au chocolat in the Ardennes. There are loads of local names, but it's only in Gascony where they took it all the way to the top. It's also one of those, you know, regional right-wing nationalism versus the modern elitist, Parisian sort of vibe. There's a lot of, like, culture stuff in it, yeah.
I was totally chocolatine team chocolatine until you told me that they were, like, you know, those guys. But you should let people know that at the beginning. They love chocolatine, but also the old way of life, wink, wink, you know?
Yeah. To be fair, when you look at it, macro politics, there's a whole like load of fascism at play here. Micro politics, it's just an argument about bread, guys. Let's get over it.
It's never just about bread.
Yeah.
No, it's no surprise that if they're members of the far right, they're getting angry about dark chocolate.
Yeah. a good point.
Anyway, sorry, I diverted you then, Ben.
No, but, that's absolutely fine. What's remarkable about this chap, Schmidt, I thought when I first heard about him that he had deliberately sort of provoked all these insects to bite him. But no, just in his research, he's been bitten by all sorts and he has four levels of pain. So level one contains insects like the southern fire ant, the western paper wasp, and the graceful twig ant. And his descriptions of the pain is delightful. So the urban diggerbee bite is categorized as almost pleasant. A lover just bit your earlobe a little too hard, which makes me very concerned about Schmidt's actual kinks and love. I don't want to kink shame anyone, but if you're bringing a hive full of urban diggerbees into the bedroom, not for me.
That's a hell of an orgy, though. The count, if yeah. It's an entire hive.
A lot of sting for your butt.
Yeah. Is that how we rate an orgy? Is it is like how good an orgy is not how many times you orgasm, it's just how many people were there.
Quantity, not quality, when it comes to orgies.
100% disagree, guys. 100%. Orgy of two, both are good looking. It's great.
Yeah.
Yeah. My other favourite description of his of a number one pain is the club-horned wasp, which he described as disappointing. A paperclip falls on your bare foot.
He's getting really cocky. He's like, do you know how many times I've been stung, bitch?
Yeah.
For a paperclip. Do you know what you are? You're a paperclip.
He's psyching out the insect world. I love it. So the next level up, pain level two, which is what most people will be accustomed with. Things like western honeybees, bald-faced hornets. The great one here is a yellow jacket sting. He described as being hot and smoky, almost irreverent. Imagine W.C. Fields extinguishing a cigar on your tongue. Like, that, I'll be honest, that sounds like a bourbon that I want to drink.
I was about to say, that definitely sounds like a whiskey I've drunk once.
Yeah.
Yeah. I love that he's gone for someone specifically putting the cigar out as well. Like, if it was Churchill putting the cigar out, now that's a different insect altogether.
That's
altogether.
An angry, aggressive thing. But,
yeah.
Whereas, whereas if it's Groucho putting out the cigar, then it's going to make you giggle and you'll hear a swanny whistle from Harper after it. Next up, pain level three, you have things like the red paper wasp and Klug's velvet ant, which sounds like it's from a different planet. My favourite description in that is from the Maricopa harvester ant. He says, after 8 unrelenting hours of drilling into that ingrown toenail, you find the drill wedged into the toe.
Oh. So that the sting is that deep?
That's certainly how it feels.
Perceives
it, even if that's not what it actually is
but
like.
The pain is as deeply embedded in your body.
Yeah. Before we get to the his most painful stings.
Sting de resistance.
The very good. Yes. He was asked what sting most surprised you, and he said, well, one that hurt more than I expected was an ordinary honeybee, but that was when it flew into my mouth and stung my tongue.
That's happened to me.
Oh, God, has it?
Yeah, I was really little and we'd gone to South Africa. You know, it's really hot there in the summer, like all countries. And and we were in this like water park and we had these lollies and all these bees came swarming around us. But we were those kids who like didn't get loads of sugar. So we wanted to keep the lollies. So we just held onto the lollies and all our cousins are screaming, drop the lollies, you stupid idiots. And we're like, lollies. I think my sister got one on her face. I got one in my mouth and on the side of my nose. It was really traumatic.
Yeah, I got stung by a wasp on my foot when I was a child, which I'm the person who, if a wasp is flying around the table, like we're eating outdoors or something, I have to get up and walk to the end of the garden as far as I'm concerned.
I so far have not been stung, and that sort of feels like I'm going to have an unpleasant third act to my life, doesn't it? The worst pain level for Schmidt, there's a couple in there. Our old friends, the bullet ants, appear. He describes this thing as pure, intense, brilliant pain, like walking over flaming charcoal with a 3-inch nail embedded in your heel.
Oof. I didn't know this was going to get like super sexy, by the way.
Yeah.
I didn't think it was that kind of podcast. I'm well in, though. I'm having a great time. But
good, I'm glad. Go well, I'll be honest, in that case, I'm glad we've turned your video off to improve the...
the quality. Connection.
Yeah.
How dare you?
The other two at pain level four, there is the warrior wasp, which he describes as torture. You are chained in the flow of an active volcano. Why did I start this list? But the worst one from it, and it is it's almost like the name and what this insect does that makes it terrifying. So the pain is described as blinding, fierce, and shockingly electric. And the venom from this insect, it is unknown what it is. And the insect is called the tarantula hawk.
Yeah, they're a horrible animal.
Horrible, silvery blue, flying, praying mantis that stings and attacks tarantulas.
Yeah, they've got, their wings look kind of like moth-like. They've got that sort of like colouring. That there's so many words. Like, it's a tarantula hawk and it's neither of those things. It's actually a wasp and it stings like a bullet ant. It's the ultimate hybrid.
You think it's what inspired Muhammad Ali? Like ages ago, but he like
captured it. Yeah, so anyone in the southern part of North America, or in northern South America, you're the ones who have to deal with this, thankfully. They're not a native over here in Europe.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, apparently when it's over here, it's daddy long legs have incredibly powerful venom, but they lack the ability to pierce human skin, so we're fine.
Yeah.
That's about as bad as it gets over here.
That sometimes is how it feels. Do you know what I mean? When you've just started doing comedy, back from like not having done it for a while, and you're on stage and you're like, I've got so much venom in me, but I don't know how to get it out to the audience, you know,
how to deliver it. Yeah.
You're right. I have on occasion in front of audiences felt like a daddy long legs with a broken proboscis. I think
no one has ever called you daddy long legs, Ben, let's be honest.
Fine. Wow. Fine. Daddy wow. Goat legs.
Yeah.
The last animal that I looked at is a venomous mammal. There's not many of them, but...
Are they mammals? The duck-billed platypus, I know, has a stingy claw.
They have little half-inch spurs that are full of horrible venom. It won't kill you, but it'll make the muscles in the area where you are stung wither away. You will shiver, you will sweat, you will throw up. The pain can last up to 3 months, and the worst bit is not even morphine will stop the pain.
Ooh,
that's the real kicker.
Why would they want to sting someone to make that happen to them? Why would they do that?
It's defense, I believe.
I mean, defense. They're not like malicious.
I've not met enough platypuses to make that call on their character.
I've never met a malicious platypus yet.
I'm trying to work out whether I'm about to write them off my list of animals I like.
But that's it, because I always think they look so cute and adorable when you see pictures of them. But actually, maybe the thing is they moved to Australia and everything else over there can try and kill you, essentially. So they thought, well, I need to fit in. They were peer pressured into getting stingers and venom.
Sorry, the platypus moved to Australia?
Evolutionarily, they showed up in Australia.
Right, so I thought you meant in some sort of like transfer window thing.
In an exchange, we got the badger. Yeah. And we said... No, I just feel like they probably were the nice kid in school in Australia, and then they've ended up taking on this trait.
Maybe when we sent all our people we didn't like to Australia, we sent all our mean animals too. And they were just like these weird, weird, weird boats. Like, where everyone's like, I know I'm a dick, but have you checked out that platypus? He's so rude. You
know? Yeah. Yeah, there were just like a brace of squirrels, cats who were bad company.
Yeah, they were like a deal to survive, but that platypus, my God.
Yeah.
For my choice, I'm staying well away from the animal kingdom, and I am going to talk about something close to my heart and also close to my feet. Lego, ladies and gentlemen. Stepping on Lego is the most painful thing in the world because it is unsuspecting. The soles of your feet have 200,000 receptors on them, and there is hard science behind why it is so painful when you walk on a Lego piece.
Oh my God, imagine being signed up to that particular test. If you volunteer like yourself as, oh, I'd be happy to do some scientific research tests, you're getting me to stand on Lego. What university funded this research?
that I'm afraid I didn't know, but the
it was a rival from Meccano.
Oh,
it was a hit job.
I take that back. I don't know if it was a university, but there has clearly been a study by the Smithsonian, because I'm about to quote them. So we may have talked before about the number of Lego bricks in the world, and their strength is remarkable. So two of them, a 2x2 put together, is basically as strong as concrete. They can withstand up to 4,240 newtons of force, or in everyday terms, 950 pounds of pressure. What, about 7 or 8 normal-sized people? It's huge.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
To be fair, you never see broken Lego, really, do you?
No, never. Listen, after the apocalypse, what's going to happen is that it's going to be Keith Richards and a bunch of cockroaches playing with Lego. I ended up looking at, I'm sure you guys are aware of people who are firewalkers and people who've taken it to the next level and done glass walking, walking over broken glass. Well, there is indeed a Lego walking challenge. The thing with walking on fire is actually, it's just embers that have been burning for an hour. And even though the embers register at almost 1,000 degrees Fahrenheit, when you walk across them, that's not how you feel. It's, you know, you can overcome that with your mental capabilities. And the same with glass walking, the way the broken pieces are spread evenly, it's hugely unlikely to pierce the skin or even set off your pain receptors. But because with Lego they've been designed to have no give, even the smallest piece of Lego will cause you astonishing amounts of pain. What do you guys think the world record is for the longest Lego walk in meters?
Do you have the context of what the longest firewalk is, just out of interest?
Well, the furthest firewalk is 200 meters.
Okay, I reckon Lego is nowhere near that. I reckon like 50 meters.
I reckon like 20 something.
Well, I've just looked it up. So from my original research, it was a chap called Russell Cassavar who walked 834 meters. And at the end, he had to be carried away because a medic saw his feet were bleeding so much.
Jesus.
However, I've just looked it up and his record has been broken last May by a chap called Salachnib Sunny Molina in Woodstock, Illinois. And he walked 8,898 meters.
What did I say, 20?
Yeah, which does slightly undermine my point, which is a shame.
No, but sorry. Oh, no, hang on. I've just checked what I was about to say out loud. And I was about to say, where is the road they made, which was 8 kilometres long, made of Lego? But I imagine he was doing this up and down a room.
Yeah.
rather than the roads in Illinois are paved with Lego, as Dick Whittington never said.
You know what? I had the exact same. I thought the same thing and I didn't even think to question it. I was like, yeah, that makes perfect sense. To me, it was like a broken. It was like Dorothy arrived in like the second movie and the entire Yellow Brick Road was broken.
Well, yeah, I've looked at photos of it and it's basically a trough of Legos that people do laps of. Yeah, it looks so horrifically painful.
Why do they do this? What's the point of it?
Oh, self-actualization and charity, I imagine. I should say that with less disdain in my voice, shouldn't I? Oh.
Yeah. There's some proper masochists in there.
There are, but I feel like I imagine masochism to be more fun, less twee, and involving less children's toys. But what do I know about the ins and outs of masochism?
It's not always in and out.
Thank you, Barry.
We recorded this on a day which you started by tweeting that you had stepped on your son's Lego 3 times already in the morning. So is this a personal vendetta, Ben?
Yeah, basically. I saw all of the Animal Kingdom, thought about which one I was most afraid of being stung by, and then I stepped on Lego 3 times and was like, fuck you, you Danish pricks.
Andrea, tell us about your pains.
but the podcast is already half over. I think we've got enough time. I have two. I have unrequited love and tonsillitis.
You have both of them at the same time.
I know. No, I had one of them ages ago and I had tonsillitis very recently. And tonsillitis is without a doubt like the most pain I've ever, ever, ever experienced in my life. It was like broken glass in my throat every time I swallowed that was ripping my throat up. I'm trying to think of a good way to describe it, the way your pain guy described pain. no, I got nothing. I'm not a poet. It was just absolutely horrible. And I was alone because everyone in my house was sort of away. And I was delirious because I had a really high fever as well. And I didn't know what to eat. I drove to a clinic. Then I realized I should go to the clinic. And I got a cab home again. And I went to see a doctor who looked down my throat and he said, oh my God, that's the worst mess I've ever seen. And I was like, that's not what you want to hear. And he gave me antibiotic. Wait, what are you laughing at?
I'm laughing because otherwise I would cry.
Yeah, it was one of those moments where, you know, there's a lot of discourse right now about sort of science and is it any good, to put a very like wide umbrella on it. And I took antibiotics. And they were very, very good, you know, like so good. They immediately took the pain from a 15 down to a 6, like in a day. It was a joyous thing because you're in like so much pain, but you're in so much less pain than you were in just a day ago. I was crying with happiness. I'd been crying for days, just like whimpering with pain. And the only thing that worked was like ice cold jelly and ice cold ice cream. And so I did that. And I was at the doctor and I made this woman, this reception, and the receptionist goes, oh my God, you look terrible. And I was like, well, that's not helping. And she, I felt so stupid about how painful the tonsillitis was that I made her promise me that it feels worse for adults than it does for kids because I couldn't stop crying. And she absolutely assured me it did, but I haven't had the guts to actually, I know, but I haven't had the guts to look it up on the internet to see if it is indeed true and adults feel it worse than kids. I can't do it. Ben, don't. I can't do it because I'm too ashamed.
I love the fact that this was the receptionist at the doctor's was already oh my God, you look terrible.
I grabbed her. It was so dramatic. I was like, tell me that this is worse for adults officially. Because I just couldn't bear it that the pain was making me into a blubbering. I mean, I had to get my dad to pick me up and take me to the doctor. I'm a grown woman. It was horrific. I couldn't even call a cab. I was just a mess. And that was all from the pain in my throat. Couldn't eat. I lost weight, but not enough for the pain.
I have a list of the NHS's top 20 worst pains. And tonsillitis isn't even on it. So I can only imagine how bad some of these things. I mean, I don't have to imagine. Shingles is top of their list, and I've had shingles, and it is not fun.
Not even on it. That's so upsetting.
Yeah, to be fair, this list, it doesn't look like it's the most complete the NHS has ever done, because childbirth is also not on the list.
That feels like quite the omission.
Well, top of their list is shingles, which I have had. Cluster headaches, frozen shoulder, broken bones, complex regional pain syndrome. I'm not really sure what that is. A heart attack is slipped in there at number 6.
I think complex regional pain syndrome is what happens when someone from Surrey ends up going to university in Glasgow.
Well, slipped disc, sickle cell disease, arthritis, migraine, sciatica, kidney stones, appendicitis, trigeminal neuralgia, acute pancreatitis, gout, endometriosis, stomach ulcer, fibromyalgia, and pain after surgery. And if anyone's playing bingo along at home, hopefully someone has shouted house if they've had a bunch of those things.
Yeah, I've had loads of that, loads of those. Yeah, no problem.
Which one stands out that isn't obviously tonsillitis? Which of those on that list?
Maybe migraine. Like, we've all had a migraine, surely.
I don't think I have, oddly enough.
The problem is, I might have had migraines, but my mum is incredibly eager to diagnose everything that I suffer as a migraine. My mum, this might be a Jewish mother thing, she's determined to diagnose everything I have as a migraine, everything that's wrong with my daughter as teething, and connect anything and everything she possibly can to the Holocaust. She has yet to connect the teething or the migraine to that, but give it time.
Give it time.
That's amazing, but I have to say, like, the two things are not like awesome, but the one, it's probably teething, mate, like most of the time. It does seem to often be teething.
Yeah, it's sort of teething in toddlers is the opposite of lupus in house.
that's a strong reference. And then you said tonsillitis was up there with unrequited love. Because you said unrequited love is, you know, a painful experience as well. And there was, I wrote an article in The Guardian this week about a doctor who had hypnotherapy for IBS. And they said that pain is sort of a protector, not a detector. It doesn't like point to symptoms. It's sort of meant to try and warn it about things. So actually, there's a lot of this is a doctor who would never have considered an alternative therapy to treat pain before. But actually, he says that in the case of a lot of persistent pain, you can rewire yourself through treatments to not be so worried about the potential pain that you might have, like IBS, for example. It's a neurological thing as opposed to just a physical thing.
I remember seeing a program with Brian Blessed and Stephen Fry. I can't remember what it is, but they basically talked about how swearing helps you endure pain.
Yeah.
And they did it with like plunging their hands into ice cold water. And they did it first time, lasted whatever, minute, 90 seconds. And then they did it and they swore. Yeah. And the swearing made it much more bearable. And they lasted 2.5-3 minutes.
No, there's been various tests about it saying that it's a very fast-acting analgesic. Yeah, there's a guy called Dr. Richard Stevens who heads at something called the Swear Lab in Keele University, where they've done things like trying to create new swear words to make it swear words which are fun to say and also to which help relieve pain.
That's
more effectively.
I'd love to know if just repeatedly going fuck, 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 fuck helps, or instead going fuckity arse titty bollocks cunt, you know, whether the compound effect of it
yeah.
is more helpful to relieving your pain.
They tested the conventional swear word fuck and two new swear words which they came up with: fouch, spelt like pouch but with an F, and twiz pipe. Fuck, apparently, they found a 32% increase in pain threshold and a 33% increase in pain tolerance. The new swear words were rated as more emotional and humorous than the neutral word that they used, but they didn't affect the pain threshold or tolerance, so fuck was much more effective than fouch or twiz pipe.
So what we've discovered is that Puritans suffer pain a lot more.
Maybe it would be sort of a personal thing, like, so if you don't have like fuck in your vocabulary, but you have like someone's name who is kind of a fuck to you.
Yeah.
Like you could use that name, you know, like damn you, Smith, you know, something like that. Like that could be your swearing. It's yeah. probably about the emotion behind it or how you use that word.
Yeah.
As much as it is the word itself, because it can't be the word itself only, because there are lots of words that rhyme with it.
There are. Oh, yeah. You couldn't be saying luck, luck, luck over again.
But it has to be connotations. It has to be emotion. It has to be emotional for it to work. So yeah. there could be like, you know, mother. That yeah. could work just as well as fuck.
Motherfucker, the ultimate is like the morphine of swear words then for you.
Well, who knows? I haven't tried it. You know, I went to an osteopath for my back pain, and he rocked me for half an hour and said that my body was haunted by pain. And I think potentially what he meant was you can rewire it neurologically and get rid of old memories of pain. But what he chose to say was, your body is haunted by pain. And I just could not after that. A bit much, you yeah. know, a bit fucking much.
Yeah, you don't want your osteopath to be a poet as well.
Yeah.
No, but also, it's like, I'm sorry, are we talking about haunting now, are we? Like, no, thank you. Like, that, just the whole thing was ridiculous. But I think I knew what he meant regardless. And I think he meant that you can rewire.
At that point you go, can I have the paracetamol rather than the Ouija board, please?
No, I'll take both, but, you know.
Very, very good. All right, tonsillitis. I mean, that sounds horrific. I've not had tonsillitis.
Well, you said it wasn't even in the top 20, so don't even worry about it.
But then again, you had a doctor go, that is the worst thing I've ever seen.
Yeah, he was just like, that is such a mess. How did you let it get that way? And I refer you to my answer before. I just don't go to the doctor. I've had to change now because, you know, things are going wrong much, much more often than they used to.
For a second, I thought you meant you had to change doctor because they refused to see you again, because that like gives them nightmares.
No, you change doctor when they won't give you the pills you want. What is wrong with you? Come on now.
Do any of you know what Socrates has to say about pain?
Ouch.
Socrates is one of those medical acronyms, like FAST, for diagnosing strokes, for example. It helps you to identify the pain and how serious it is. S is for site, where is the pain, or the maximal site of the pain. O is for onset, where did the pain start, was it sudden or gradual? What's the character, what's the pain like, is it an ache, is it a stabbing? Radiation, does the pain radiate anywhere else? Associations, any other signs or symptoms associated with the pain. Time course, does the pain follow any pattern? E, exacerbating or relieving factors, anything change the pain? And S, severity, how bad is the pain? Which would seem like a question that should be up at the top rather than at the bottom.
Well, you can swap the S's then.
Yeah, they found themselves in hock to the acronym there, I think. The Wikipedia article on the Socrates method says, this is frequently misused by doctors and medical practitioners. It's quite a long acronym to remember every bit of it, I think. They usually tend to be a bit shorter than that, like RICE and FAST.
If you need an acronym to ask relevant questions about new presenting pain,
yeah.
You're not a very good doctor.
Yeah. And particularly if someone is like, I'm in such serious pain, or they're like, we've only gotten to see, please let me finish the diagnosis.
Yeah, like, FAST is for us, it's not for them.
Yeah.
Like Socrates is for us. Like, if you know, there's a zombie apocalypse and it's like, oh, Socrates, and they're just like, just give me a drug.
Yeah.
Like, I don't want any of this nonsense. They should know Socrates. I want them to at least know that.
Well, I mean, the worst bit surely is if you're in pain and you're trying to remember how to process it using the wrong Greek philosopher, like Aristotle. Aristotle. No,
yeah.
A is for agony.
Yeah.
I looked at some things that could be used in pain relief that were unusual. Spider venom.
Mm-hmm.
Pain that isn't relieved with current treatments. Apparently, some scientists reckon that spider venom is going to be an effective substitute for regular painkillers. A lot of spiders use compounds in their venom to paralyze their prey. So it's not so mad to think that you could reduce the pain in someone by paralyzing certain parts, certain very specific areas. So scientists recently identified 7 compounds in tarantula venom that block an important step in how the body processes pain. It turns off one of the body's sodium channels called NAV1.7, which sends pain signals to the brain.
I'm fairly certain that is an American airbase, but as you were.
NAV1.7, yeah. Yeah. Well, this is University of Queensland, apparently. It would, of course, be the Australians who'd go to spider venom. They have designed a novel tarantula venom mini protein that can potentially help relieve severe pain, and it doesn't have addictive qualities like a lot of opioid painkillers do. So that's the big point behind it, is that there's a big opioid crisis, a lot of addiction.
How strong is it?
They're still testing it.
Could it be used for Ben's muscle dead area that lasts 3 months and morphine doesn't work for? Could they throw some spider venom proteins in there?
For the platypus?
Into that gaping hole that I've yeah.
You've just got to really hope that the spider venom doesn't become addictive, because it's hard to judge that, I imagine, and suddenly you get these people who are running out into the great Australian desert, digging in spider nests, going, I need more spiders.
I'm a 20 tarantula a day man myself.
You know what? Those people deserve everything they get. Yeah. You don't mess around with spiders. You
yeah.
Break into all the pharmacies you want, but you're going and getting spider's venom from them. It's rude.
Yeah, to be fair. Yeah, well, this Dr. Christina Schroeder is the head scientist behind this at the University of Queensland's Institute for Molecular Bioscience. And she says, although opioids are effective in producing pain relief, they come with unwanted side effects like nausea, constipation, and the risk of addiction, placing a huge burden on society. And they have been testing this tarantula venom on mouse subjects at the moment, and it's shown to work pretty effectively. So the jury is still out as to whether it'll be as effective on, you know, a large enough scale.
What are they doing to cause the mice enough pain? Like, it does feel a bit weird that we're talking about trying to make the strongest painkiller in the world, so we're just going to breeze past the fact that they're testing it on mice, and we don't ask the question, how do they produce that much pain in such a tiny animal?
That's very true. They watch a lot of Tom and Jerry cartoons, so there's a lot of anvils being dropped and mallets being hit on the mouse's tail and things like that.
Oh, God! That's what I'm talking about. Yeah. What are they? Yeah, like, is it anvils? Please let it be anvils. Please let it not be psychological torture.
On a similar vein, bee venom acupuncture, to be more specific, has been used to treat rheumatoid arthritis, osteoarthritis, and gout. Apparently, in one study, 82% of patients treated with bee venom stings reported significant pain relief. Nearly 100 studies of testing bee venom acupuncture. Dr. Darla Logan from Arizona. She says most of these studies demonstrate bee venom acupuncture is an effective pain treatment. Honey bee venom increases blood circulation, softens the tissue, reduces inflammation, and increases dopamine, norepinephrine, and serotonin, which gives you an emotional boost as well as actual physical side effects.
Oh, it's delightful to get a nice little pickup as well as a bonus.
Apparently, doctors sometimes prescribe sterilized bee venom for patients to inject themselves at home, which is rather than giving you the hive to take home, like Ben suggested earlier. Bee venom is also used in skin cream and dietary supplements, apparently. So when people say bee stung lips, I imagine it's... and electricity, electrical stimulation, known as transcutaneous electrical nerve stimulation, or TENS, zaps electricity through your muscles and causes them to contract and release. You stick little stickers on you like you do a defibrillator, but on the lower back or on the neck and the shoulder, and a little electrical voltage direct to the muscle helps it relieve chronic muscle pain. For about 50% of people find it effective in studies.
And the other 50% of people go, ow, 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 ow.
Yeah. Apparently the electrical impulses help release endorphins again. It's always endorphins and serotonin with these people, isn't it? Of course, one of us had to find something horrifying in the animal kingdom and in Australia, and I have combined the two for my world's worst pain, and I'm going to talk about Irukandji syndrome.
I already dislike it.
Irukandji syndrome comes from box jellyfish, specific box jellyfish, and in the last 20 years or so, it's caused a couple of deaths. It's as serious as that. Cardiac arrest can sometimes occur, and the most common jellyfish to cause this is called Carukia barnesi. It's a species of Irukandji jellyfish found off the coast of northern Queensland. And they are about the size of a grape, which is obviously not ideal if you're trying to avoid them. Very dangerous box jellyfish that most people know about, the most venomous marine creature in the world, has caused about 80 deaths in Australia since they started recording these things. But nets around Australian beaches can catch box jellyfish and sharks and things like that. But the Irukandji are so small that they can get through very easily. And in a normal summer season, apparently lifeguards in Queensland will treat up to 20,000 sting victims, a lot of them from this Carukia barnesi. They're practically invisible as well. They're very pale.
Tiny, invisible, incredibly painful jellyfish.
That is exactly what I'm talking about. And the reason it's called the Irukandji syndrome was named, it was named before they identified the source of it, because people in Queensland and Australia were having these stings but not knowing they'd been stung, and then were having this apparent syndrome where they were, you know, vomiting and having nausea and sweating and back pain and muscle pain and chest pains and anxiety and hypertension and tachycardia and pulmonary edema, sometimes lasting up to 4 hours, sometimes as long as 30 hours, and could take up to 2 weeks to resolve completely. So seemingly inexplicably, people in northern Queensland were just having these attacks of what a guy called Hugo Flecker named Irukandji syndrome. The Aboriginal Irukandji live in Palm Cove, north of Cairns in Queensland, so that's where the stings were common, and that's how he named it in the 50s. Do you know how you treat a jellyfish sting?
I know that you don't urinate on it, because that is a bit of an urban myth.
You basically want acid, some sort of acidic thing. So vinegar is the number one thing.
How is that not the correct way to do it? I think we all know why we know it, and I think it is the correct way. I've never heard anyone say it's not.
Yeah, no, apparently it doesn't necessarily make it better. There's some people suggest it might even make it worse. Seawater is one of the things people say you should use to help remove the actual barb from your skin. If you can see it, obviously these jellyfish are so small, it's quite hard to see it. Acetic acid, which you find in vinegar, is the number one thing.
So is that why fish and chips is a traditional seaside dish?
Yeah, fish and chips is there. Obviously the number one treatment for jellyfish stings is to rub your fish and chips.
Yeah, yes.
The thing that really freaks me out about it, you mostly get stung by these during the wet season, October to May in North Queensland. But they're so small, it's just to the tip of the sting. And so initially it might just feel nothing more than a mosquito bite. It's so minuscule. And then the symptoms get worse over the course of the next 5 minutes to 2 hours. And like I say, it's got an array of symptoms and can occasionally be fatal. There's no antivenom available for it as well. So treatment is usually just analgesics, trying to support and while you're going through this agony. So obviously, sounds terrible. The real clincher for me as to why I picked this was how it was discovered, the source of this syndrome. So as I say, it was named in the 50s, the Irukandji syndrome. In 1964, a gentleman called John Handyside Barnes, or Jack Barnes, who was a physician and toxinologist in Queensland and also a former military guy, he became, in his time, famous for researching box jellyfish, establishing that their toxins wouldn't be discharged on synthetic surfaces. So he would wear tights when collecting specimens. Apparently, that's a thing that lifesavers do when they're at risk of jellyfish stings. But he confirmed the syndrome came from jellyfish in 1964, determined that it came when they fired out their stingers out of their body and into people as they passed by. And he did this by catching a tiny jellyfish, testing it on himself, and then testing it on his 14-year-old son, and then also on a local lifeguard who came over to see how they were doing.
Oh, I love it. This is the William Tell School of Empiricism.
Wow.
All three of them, you'll be glad to hear, were rushed to hospital and survived. And you remember the name of the most common jellyfish I mentioned earlier on, the Carukia barnesi?
Mm-hmm.
It's named after him, Jack Barnes. So he is the one who put himself and his family member through it. And I'm just going to quote a doctor describing the sting. They say you get cramping in the muscles of the legs, moving up into the abdomen, into the chest, into the arms. It's the really severe cramping pains that people become totally distraught by. It comes in waves, rather like labor pain, getting stronger and stronger. You need vast doses of morphine to control the pain. Victims get a really severe headache and begin vomiting. They feel absolutely dreadful. A feeling of impending doom is how they describe it.
I'll be honest, that just sounds like parenting with a hangover.
It really does, doesn't it?
And he chose to, in the name of science, he chose to take on that pain and the impending doom and then share it with his 14-year-old son.
I'm sure there are parents of 14-year-old children listening to this going, seems absolutely fair.
So our candidates this week for the world's worst pain are Ben's suggestion of stepping on Lego, the scourge of many a parent. Andrea's suggestion of tonsillitis, as experienced by Andrea very recently.
Really specific. Yeah. Specifically about me.
But also tonsillitis that made one medical professional, for all we know, quit their job.
Because he did insult me quite a bit.
Yeah, and my suggestion of Irukandji syndrome, the tiny invisible jellyfish stinger that gives you a sense of impending doom. I'm not going to lie, guys, that description of the Irukandji syndrome absolutely clinched it for me when I read it last night, having skimmed through reading articles about the anti-vaccination demonstrations in Canada, the rumours of a cabinet reshuffle, the sense of impending doom we're already living with was bad enough. Made worse by a tiny invisible jellyfish that can sting you by spraying out into the water. And
in a way, aren't we all Irukandji syndrome?
Irukandji syndrome is a mood of 2022, is what you're saying.
Yeah, I feel like very strongly that is the vibe.
Yeah. Right now. So I think because it speaks to me physically, but also emotionally at the moment. And also, it's nice to find an Australian stinging/vicious animal that isn't a spider. It's good to spread it around a little bit. Before we go, I've got to give you some of the world's best news of the week. And this story comes from Cincinnati, Ohio. Jasper the Siamese cat. So many of my good news stories are about cats, I think. Jasper the Siamese cat used to spend hours entranced by Melissa Krieger's exotic pets, fish, as he gazed through the saltwater enclosure from a dining room chair. And the supplier that Melissa had, Jason Herring, was cleaning the tank last year. And he and Melissa put their heads together to come up with a unique design to improve Jasper's viewing habits. So Jason cleans Melissa's many fish tanks every couple of weeks. So he spent 16 hours making see-through acrylic panes, building a wooden base for it to stand on. And three-year-old Jasper now sits upright on a cushion beneath the case, poking his head through a little hatch so it's in the middle of the fish tank, looking at all the fish one swimming around his head. It is absolutely adorable. I've been to the aquarium in Brighton where they have one of these little globes you can sort of walk under and stick your head up so you're in one of the tanks, and it is exactly like that. The video was put up at the end of January and it has had more than 10 million views.
That is a healing piece of news that you have shared with us.
That is beautiful.
Yeah, they were a little bit anxious about trying the hatch out at first, apparently. Jason Herring may be onto something here because he did charge a $2,400 for the tank. But she described Jasper's first experience with the tank, saying his eyes just got huge when he looked up and saw the parrotfish and they were staring back at him. That's what made him want to go inside it more.
You're damn right it did.
Yeah, he bugged out the first time he saw it.
Who wouldn't want to put their head in a hatch full of fish if he was that? That's amazing. What a lovely thing to do for your pet.
Yeah, it's really cute. Before we go, Andrea, where can people find out more about you and come see you and all of that stuff?
My Twitter is Shut Up Andrea.
You will occasionally catch Andrea and Ben in the same room at the same time.
Two Jews on a comedy bell. What is this, America in the 1950s?
I'm not plugging a show this year, and I keep getting to fights on Twitter, so I'm not entirely convinced I'm plugging my Twitter either.
Anyway, we're all off to build a Lego model of Socrates and get Ben to try and climb all over it. Thank you for listening to Westwood Forward. Goodbye.
Bye.